is edition number 2011 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Thursday the 2nd of April, 2026. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today, we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News on Thursday, the 2nd of April, 2026. My name is Cynthia Gosling, and my fellow readers are...
Chris Allen.
Christine Barraclough.
And Caroline Allen.
On the news board today... This week, the sun will rise around 6:15 and, if all goes well, will set at about 7:40.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes a bodyguard, a new footpath, some books and a visit to the RNLI in Cromer.
But we begin with the main news items, which include trouble for Aylsham Market stallholders, an indecent video of school pupil circulating, council restructuring and the heating oil crisis. Let's start with those lead stories.
It has been the heartbeat of a Norfolk community for around 800 years. Aylsham Market showcases the best of what the local businesses has to offer in the town centre, with some traders selling from their stalls for more than 50 years. But now, traders and shoppers alike are worried about the market's future after Aylsham Town Council hiked the on-the-day pitch fees by 67% with only 6 days' notice. And some stallholders have already packed their bags in response, saying that the charge increase has made it unviable to continue. However, the council has claimed that it has not increased fees since 2018 and said costs are now closely aligned with those of other market towns. It has also said it has given reductions for businesses paying 6 months in advance or annually. Stuart Youngs, who runs a stall for key cutting and watch batteries, has now decided to leave Aylsham Market after 8 years of trading, claiming the rise would make trading there unviable. He said a huge rent increase such as this really affects small traders like us on the market, and although they gave us the option to pay 6 months or a year in advance to keep the price down, that's just not viable for most of the traders in the current climate. Aylsham itself is a great little town and the customers there are fantastic. But with increased fuel and market rents, it's becoming unviable for me to trade there. He will continue to trade at other markets across Norfolk, including at Sheringham. Heather Miller is another trader who has decided to leave the market following the council's notice just weeks after starting there. She described the change as huge and totally unexpected. If I wish to continue to pay £9 a week, I need to pay 6 months in advance by bank transfer, £207. Should I still wish to pay weekly, that would increase to £15 per week, a 66% increase. For me, it's out of the question to pay 6 months in advance. Deborah Dixon, who now runs Debbie's Pet Supplies, but formerly ran Debbie's Household Goods since 1987, is one of the traders who has been left concerned by the changes. I have run the market over the years and I am really quite upset about it. We were only given 6 days' notice. We are a lifeline for the elderly people and us traders are like a little family. We are already struggling, and this is another blow. Her husband, Cecil Dixon, also manages his own stall called Lilac Nurseries, which was first started by his father, Stanley, in 1973. He said, "We are gutted. This is not what we needed." Mr. Dixon added that this may be one of the largest increases in recent years and criticised the lack of notice the council gave, noting that Swaffham Market was told of a 3% increase 3 months in advance. A spokeswoman for the Aylsham Town Council said for traders who choose to pay annually in advance, fees will be lower than they are currently, and those paying 6 months in advance will see no change. These are the rates in place since 2018, but traders claim that there was a fee review in 2021. Our on-the-day charges have been reviewed and are now more closely aligned with those of other market towns, representing a fair reflection of the benefits provided, she said. The council added that it has secured a £6,500 grant from Norfolk County Council's High Streets Matter scheme to help increase footfall in the town centre. Of this funding, £1,909 has been specifically allocated to provide entertainment at the food and craft markets, helping to attract more visitors to the marketplace and support traders.
A warning has been issued about an indecent video of a pupil that has spread around schools in Norfolk. The email, seen by this paper, was sent to parents by Reefham High School on Tuesday, March the 24th. It included a message from police regarding a Year 7 student at a Norfolk school who created an inappropriate video of themselves. According to The Force, the footage may have been circulated among students at several high schools, listing Reefham, as well as Needshead and Northgate in Dereham. Officers said the matter would be addressed through education instead of prosecution, although this could change if any future incidents were reported. In the letter, Norfolk Police said, "It is a criminal offence to take, create, share or possess indecent images or videos of anyone under the age of 18, even if the content is self-generated. Such actions can have serious consequences, including police involvement, the seizure of electronic devices, and a lasting impact on future education and employment opportunities. In some cases, offences may carry significant custodial sentences. Once shared, images or videos can spread quickly and may never be fully removed, potentially putting those involved at risk of harm." The Force has also advised parents who know their children has received or is in possession of such material to encourage them not to share it further and report it to a trusted adult immediately. A spokesman for Synergy Multi Academy Trust, which is responsible for Reefham High School, said, "As always, we assist the police by sharing information from them as requested." Enrich Learning Trust, which is responsible for Needshead High and Unity Education Trust, which runs Northgate High, have both been approached for comment. Anyone with information or concerns about the creation or circulation of indecent images has been advised to report this to police via 101, online or 999 in an emergency.
Norfolk's 8 councils are to be scrapped and replaced with 3 new super authorities covering the east and west of the county, along with one for Greater Norwich. After months of speculation, the government has confirmed it has plumped for the creation of three new unitary councils in the biggest shake-up of Norfolk's councils in more than 50 years. It will mean the abolition of Norfolk County Council, Norwich City Council, South Norfolk Council, Broadland District Council, Breckland District Council, North Norfolk Council, Great Yarmouth Borough Council, and West Norfolk Council. They will be replaced by three new councils, Greater Norwich, West Norfolk, and East Norfolk, unitary authorities providing all the services in the area they cover. That is unlike the current setup, where some services, such as roads, adult social care, and children's services, are the responsibility of County Hall, while the districts, borough and city handle others, such as recycling, environmental health and planning. The government had invited authorities to suggest what should happen in the shake-up, and Steve Reed, local government secretary, picked the future Norfolk three council model, put forward by Norwich, Broadland, Breckland, North Norfolk, Great Yarmouth and West Norfolk. It will see a Greater Norwich Council on extended boundaries, taking in parts of South Norfolk and Broadland. The East Norfolk Council takes in areas such as Great Yarmouth, but also places such as Wyndham, Cromer, Sheringham, Fakenham, and even Wells next to the sea. The West Norfolk Council takes in towns such as King's Lynn, Dereham, Swaffham, Thetford, Downham Market, Hunstanton and Wotton.
A £3 million heating oil crisis fund has been launched to support homes in Norfolk affected by rising prices. Around 70,000 households in the county, which is 17% of its homes, rely on the fuel for heating and hot water. Many have seen the price of their heating oil double since the start of the war in the Middle East. Norfolk County Council's Crisis Fund will offer help to low-income families, typically households with a combined income of under £35,000 a year. The council says it will also take savings and any outstanding debts into account to ensure the support reaches those who need it most. Priority will be given to those who are set to run out of your oil and are at immediate risk of losing access to heating and hot water. People will be asked to provide information about themselves and anyone else who lives with them. This includes 2 months of bank statements, details of outstanding debts, and whether they have any oil payment plan in place. Once eligibility is confirmed, the council will offer grants of around £350 per household. There is also support available around setting up a payment plan with oil suppliers. Tom Maccabee, Chief Executive Officer at Norfolk County Council, said, "This is a moment of real crisis for many Norfolk residents. The Norfolk Heating Oil Crisis Fund will offer practical and timely support to those who are facing hardship. Norfolk's rural communities face unique pressures, and the sharp rise in heating oil costs is landing hardest on the households least able to absorb it. We want everyone to know that help is here, and we are committed to supporting Norfolk families through this difficult period." The Norfolk Heating Oil Crisis Fund is funded through a £3 million top-up to the 2026-27 Crisis and Resilience Fund from the government. Earlier this month, the Prime Minister announced £53 million of support for UK households affected by rising heating oil prices. to apply for the Council's crisis funding, visit www.norfolk.gov.uk/heatingoil, and those who cannot access support online can call 0344 800 8020.
Plans for a new car park have emerged to relieve pressures on Norfolk Town Centre. Aylsham Town Council has submitted a proposal to Broadland Council for a new transport hub and car parking off Norwich Road. The proposed site is set to offer 62 parking spaces and cycle stands for 10 bikes, forming part of the approved 250-home development currently under construction on the same road. In the documents, the council said the parking area would relieve pressures on the town centre and provide an area for those wishing to travel further afield, such as to Cromer or Norwich via bus. Solar panels have also been proposed on some of the parking spaces to generate electricity for the site, alongside height barriers for vehicles. Lighting will be designed with consideration to adjacent users, while providing for a safe and secure development, the documents added. The major housing scheme to the south of the proposed car park was lodged by developers Norfolk Homes and Saffron Homes and approved at the end of 2024. Once completed, it will include 252 new houses, a care home, and public open spaces.
A fresh call has gone out for 1,500 new emergency responder volunteers. St John Ambulance is seeking 1,500 recruits across England, including more than 120 in the east of England, to support its work at events and in communities. Volunteer roles are available in Norwich, Mulbarton, North Walsham, Swaffham, King's Lynn and Great Yarmouth. Kevin Munday, Chief Commissioner at St John Ambulance, said, "Volunteering with St John Ambulance is one of the most rewarding things you can do, and as an emergency responder, you really are there in the moments that matter. You might be the person who brings calm to a frightening situation, provides urgent care, or help someone safely on their way home or into the hands of the NHS. Emergency responders deliver frontline first aid and clinical care, offering support to those who are injured or suddenly unwell. Volunteers must be 18 or older, but no previous experience is required, as full training will be provided. Each responder is typically asked to give around 100 hours of volunteering per year."
Norfolk's bus users are pretty happy with their service, according to an annual satisfaction survey. The watchdog, Transport Focus, has revealed the results of its latest Your Bus Journey study. It shows overall journey satisfaction in Norfolk was 88% for 2025, placing the county 17th in England. This is up from its 86% satisfaction score in 2024 and the 81% result in 2023. The survey classifies the county as a rural area, reflecting its long routes, scattered villages, and often thin timetables. But its score keeps pace with bigger networks, such as the Liverpool City Region and Leicester City, which also sit on 88%. The real high flyers are Warwickshire and Greater Nottingham, sharing the top spot on 93% satisfaction. They are followed closely by Reading Buses and Portsmouth on 92%, with a run of other areas in the low 90s, showing how tight it is at the top of the chart. First in Norfolk also did well on the top operator ranking, coming in 26th place of the top 50. This part of the report only looked at operators with more than 150 journeys in each area.
The first cable for the world's largest offshore wind farm has been pulled ashore at Norfolk Village. The line, which weighs 50 kg per metre, has arrived at Weybourne from Danish energy company Ørsted's Hornsea 3 offshore wind farm. It marks a significant milestone for the 8.5 billion project. Once reaching landfall, the cable will be buried underground on a 30-mile, 50-kilometre route through the countryside, arriving at a converter station in Swardeston on the outskirts of Norwich. Throughout 2026, more than 420 miles, 680 kilometres of export cable will be laid, allowing energy generated by the wind farm to reach over 3.3 million UK homes. The fabrication of the Hornsea 3 export cables began 3 years ago and will be completed this summer. Luke Bridgman, Managing Director of Ørsted's Hornsea 3, said, "The arrival of the first cable onshore marks a significant milestone for the Hornsea 3 and is a testament to the hard work of our teams at Ørsted, Jean de Nul and NKT. Every element of this wind farm is being completed safely, efficiently and sustainably by experts in their field. The Hornsea 3 wind farm is located around 75 miles, 120 kilometres off the coast of Norfolk."
Our next few news stories include concerns over plans for a major chicken farm in Alton, 100 new homes agreed for Reefham, stricter fines for fly tippers, and the strange death of four pigs.
Plans for a major chicken farm on the edge of a Norfolk town have been met with backlash as villagers fear severe impacts from it. E.F. Harold, which farms around Aylsham, hopes to build four poultry houses on land off the street in Alton, near Causton, to produce around 1.36 million chickens a year. The company submitted the plans for the site of Docking Farm to Broadland Council. Its bid also includes new feed bins, service buildings, access improvements and drainage infrastructure. But nearby parish councils have objected to the proposal, raising several concerns over the impact it would have on those living in the area. This includes fears over the increased traffic on the local road network, as well as an increase of noise, particularly as operations are sometimes set to take place at night. This will include when the birds are caught, as it is understood that the birds are quieter and calmer in dark conditions. Alton Parish Council said the scraping of forklifts on a concrete apron is a notoriously disturbing noise, which is proposed to be carried out at night on the apron to the north of the sheds, i.e. closest to the nearest neighbours. This would create an utterly unacceptable disturbance and constitute a risk to the health of the occupants of the nearest residential properties. The council added that the light levels inside the sheds are within the control of the handlers and suggested that the applicant should reconsider the need for night-time working. If this is not possible, then the Parish Council recommends the refusal of the application on the grounds of the unacceptable severe impacts on the near neighbours, it said. Cawston Parish Council has also raised concerns that the submitted traffic management plan depends on temporary infrastructure, such as passing places and a speed limit as part of offshore wind projects, which will be removed in the future. The Environmental Quality Team has also objected to the bid due to unacceptable odour levels on a nearby home. Instead, the team has suggested that the firm should consider moving the proposed poultry houses across to the south of the site. The District Council will make a decision in due course.
Plans to build more than 100 new homes in Reefham have been given the final seal of approval. An application was put forward by Lovell Homes for the development on land west of Broomhill Lane. This would see 141 homes built on the site, with 28% being earmarked for affordable housing. A mix of one- and two-storey properties, ranging from one to four bedrooms, have been proposed. The plans also include an associated open space, highway and landscaping works, and an extension to the existing Reefham Cemetery. Initial plans for the development were given the green light at a planning meeting in September 2022. This stage involved a Section 106 agreement regarding the level of affordable housing and contributions towards a new sports hall for Reefham High School, as well as public transport, among others. It was agreed not to start the development until details of the provider and the timeline for the provision of affordable homes were both approved. The document also mentioned offering the cemetery extension land to Reefham Town Council prior to the first occupation of any home. The agreement also highlighted that a total of £100,000 towards a public transport contribution would be made before occupation of any home. A design and access statement with the application said, "The inclusion of affordable housing mixed with open market housing will help to deliver an integrated development to the town. The development has been designed with the local community in mind, ensuring the build form fits attractively within the existing build form. The additional housing will provide support for local business in and around Reefham." The decision to approve the plans was confirmed by Broadland District Council on March 18th. To view the application in full, visit the Council's planning portal.
A Norfolk Council is set to enforce stricter fines for fly tippers after more than 450 cases were reported in 3 years. Councillors at North Norfolk District Council have passed a motion to raise fixed penalty notices for fly tipping to the legal maximum of £1,000 and to explore more avenues for investigating perpetrators. The agreed motion also included lobbying the government to amend the Environmental Protection Act 1990 to better protect landowners when fly tipping takes place on their land. It comes after the council recorded 462 incidents over the past 3 years, with 47 cases alone reported on public land in October 2025. Councillor Callum Ringer said, "Where we can prosecute, we should prosecute, and we do, but we also need the tools to do that effectively, and at the moment, those tools don't always exist. That is something that is holding back local enforcement, and it doesn't act as a very good deterrent. Something needs to change centrally to indicate the government are serious about tackling environmental crime. Where clear evidence is present, the council can prosecute environmental crimes. But often, with rural crimes, there is often no CCTV or witnesses. There have also been 81 reported fly-tipping incidents on private land in the three-year period. Currently, the landowner has the financial responsibility of clearing any fly-tipping on their property. The amendment proposes that the government take financial responsibility for the removal of that waste. In response to the passed motion, some people on social media have raised issues with booking recycling centres and tips, linking this to the increased fly-tipping incidents. One argued, if you make it more difficult to dispose of waste, what do you expect as the outcome? However, Mr. Ringer has clarified that the tips are run by Norfolk County Council and not the District Council.
The strange and suspicious death of four pigs on a North Norfolk farm has prompted a warning for livestock keepers to bolster their security against intruders. David Otley runs a small outdoor pig herd at Otley's Blue Welly farm in Bacton, supplying free-range pork and hog roasts. But he was devastated to find four of his animals dead after two apparent attacks last Friday and Saturday night. Two were trapped in stock fencing after having been spooked enough to run into an electric fence, and two others in a separate paddock appear to have suffered heart attacks, he said. He believes it was a deliberate attempt to scare or steal the pigs, having ruled out an attack by a wild animal due to a lack of bite marks or tracks. To add to the mystery, he spotted a black transit-type van driving away from a farm track on Sunday night, and when he mentioned the pig deaths at a slaughterhouse on Monday, he discovered another farm near Fakenham had recently reported a similar experience. Although police have been informed, Mr. Otley admits there is very little evidence to go on, but he is warning other farms to be on their guard. I have been doing this for 30 years, so I know when something is just not normal, he said. We have lost four pigs. Two were stuck in stock fencing, which is highly unusual. These pigs have been behind electric fencing all their lives, so they know what the fencing is. For this to happen, something has really spooked them. They chose to go through the electric fence and hit the stock fence behind it so hard they were knocking fence posts down. The other two in the other finishing paddock had definitely had heart attacks. They must have been terrified, because you don't normally end up with dead pigs like that either. It really is strange. I initially thought it might be animal rights activists or someone playing silly buggers. It could have been someone trying to steal the pigs. We have nothing to go on. There is no evidence. But I am certain it is human activity. If it was an animal, there would have been marks on them. There has certainly been some strange activity, and we have just got to raise awareness that people should heighten their security. It could literally mean checking your animals later in the night and watching who is around during the day.
The Red Arrows will return to the skies over North Norfolk this summer. The famous Red Jets are flying over the Cromer Carnival on August the 19th, with the exact flight time yet to be confirmed. We are absolutely thrilled to announce that the world-famous RAF Red Arrows will once again be joining us for Cromer Carnival, a spokesman for the event said. Get ready for an unforgettable display as they take to the skies, bringing breathtaking stunts, precision flying, and that iconic red, white and blue. This is always a highlight of Carnival Day, and we can't wait to see the skies above Cromer filled with colour and excitement once again. The lineup for the event also includes stunts from Bulldog FMX, a motorcycle display team. Bulldog FMX brings a jaw-dropping show built around the world's largest and most advanced mobile landing system. The David Seamark sheepdog display will take to the arena, where up to five highly skilled dogs work with sheep and geese in a live demonstration.
Two country estates in Norfolk have been named among the best places to see Blossom. The Sun published a ranking of the top National Trust sites to see spring blooms across the UK. The Fellbrigg and Blickling estates, both run by the National Trust, were included. The main Fellbrigg Hall was built in the 17th century, but the wider estate can be traced back even further. The site near Cromer contains acres of parkland and woodland, perfect for taking an afternoon stroll. A highlight is the walled garden, where Blossom grows on fruit trees and historic varieties. Visitors can enter for £18 per adult or £8 per child. Meanwhile, Blickling Hall near Aylsham is more than 400 years old. It is well known for its association with Anne Boleyn, who is believed to have been born there. There are also lots of lovely gardens and green spaces to explore around the home, and as the Sun pointed out, magnolias can be seen in bloom in white and pink in the West Garden. It costs £18 per adult and £9 per child to visit.
The gardens of a Jacobean manor house on the North Norfolk coast will open to the public for tours with the owner this year. Wiverton Hall's gardens will be open for its first spring tour with Desmond McCarthy, who will guide visitors through the grounds on Thursday, April the 9th. The tour will begin at 11 a.m. and invites guests to explore the vibrant walled kitchen garden and the secluded sunk garden with its views across the Clye marshes. Mr. McCarthy will share stories of the house and the normal for Norfolk life that has made Wiverton a destination in the area. The gardens are a family passion in memory of Chloe, Desmond's mother, and flourish particularly vibrantly due to their close proximity to the sea. Tickets are priced at £15 per person and can be purchased online. April the 9th is just the first tour of the season, with future tours scheduled for May the 27th, June the 25th, July the 9th and July the 30th. Norfolk Tea Company now runs the cafe on site, and thirsty tourers can pop in for a drink and some cake afterwards.
The location of Norfolk's new Pick Your Own Dahlia field has been revealed. Wild Dahlia Co. was created by two best friends, Harriet Henderson and Eleanor Ames. Both women have full-time jobs and families, and growing flowers has proven to be the perfect way to unwind. Last year, they announced they would launch a Pick Your Own flower field in 2026 to share their creations with the world. Their vision was to design the field like a secret garden with plenty of photo opportunities along the way. But some new details have now emerged as the pair have said the field will be located at Beck Farm in Weybourne. People will be welcomed through the gates sometime in July, which is when dahlias usually start to bloom. They often stay in flower until the first frost. Our style is wild, beautiful and a bit untamed, Miss Henderson and Miss Amy said. That's what our dahlias are, what the farm is, and what we hope every visitor experiences when they visit. You are listening to edition number 2011 of The Mardler, recorded on Thursday, the 2nd of April, 2026. Still to come, there are items about solar farms and phone signals, and of course, the Mardler magazine supplement. But before all of that, just one letter to the editor of the North Norfolk News.
Ray Gilding of Aylsham writes, "My wife and I attended the little consultation in Aylsham Town Hall on Tuesday, March 10th. Firstly, I am not bothered whether Aylsham has a little store or not. However, it seems a waste of time, because we got the impression that no matter what opinions the residents of Aylsham give, they will be totally ignored. People were filling in forms which were asking the residents' opinions. So, being a bit of a cynic, I asked what I considered a fair question. One of the questions I asked the little representative was, will Little take any notice of the residents' opinions, especially if the majority of opinions are against having a little store on the edge of the town? The reply I got from the representative was that this is not a referendum. So, even if residents don't want the store, or the council doesn't agree to the building, they would just reapply for planning consent, presumably until they get the answer they want. Another question was asked. Why is the store not being built on the industrial estate? The reply was that because the land changed ownership and they couldn't negotiate with the new owner. In other words, the new owner wouldn't accept their offer, I suspect. So, to me, this proves public consultations are a waste of time, because the public's opinion is ignored. These consultations are companies / organisations paying lip service to the public having an opinion. In other words, we will listen to you, but we won't take any notice of your opinions. And we will do what we want."
And now to this week's obituaries. Jean Blair passed away peacefully at home on March 11th, 2026, aged 86. Beloved wife of John, deceased, dearly loved mum and grandma. The funeral service will take place at St Margaret's Church, Fellbrigg, on Tuesday, April the 7th at 1:30 p.m. Family flowers only, please. If desired, donations for Fellbrigg Church may be left at the service. All inquiries to Fox's Funeral Services, telephone 01263 512 427.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we hear about a hobby you can stick to, find out what it takes to be a bodyguard, discover the health benefits of a new footpath, take a seasonal trip to Book Corner, and visit the RNLI in Cromer.
Begin with an article published in the Just Wroxham and Coltishall magazine on the 21st of February 2026. Here, the aptly named Norfolk writer considers a new hobby that he managed to stick at. It started as a joke when I bought the latest Professional Darts Corporation sticker album in December. It came with 6 packets of stickers. I only wanted one, Luke Littler, as a quirky addition to the wall in my office. I didn't get a little sticker. For some reason, though, perhaps to get a sense of value from my unwise investment, I stuck the 30 non-Luke Littler stickers in my album. It was a weirdly pleasurable experience. Tearing across the thin paper of the packets at the top, pulling out the thin wad of stickers, artfully thumbing them at the corner, prizing them from the backing paper, then, lastly, attempting to place them in the album with the meticulousness of a bomb disposal unit in fierce desert heat. And that was that, or so I thought. There is a tragic flaw in the male psyche that has kept the Panini sticker business in rude health for decades, namely that the more stickers we put into a sticker album, the emptier the sticker album looks. The gaps appear more pronounced, as though mocking our attempt. A masculine urge kicks in. Fill the gaps, ASAP. Few things show a person's age better than the price they used to pay for stickers. For me, it was always 20 pence for 6 stickers, an exchange rate that I considered most agreeable when I was collecting Premier League 93 and WWF wrestling stickers in those halcyon days of the latter 20th century. Even back then, though, there were wise old hounds sneeringly telling me that they used to pay 6 pence halfpenny, or some other vague dead currency, for a similar return. Now I'm the wise old hound. You may feel like one, too, when I tell you the price of a single packet of stickers. Ladies and gentlemen, they are £1 a pop, and you only get 5 in a pack, not 6. And like everything else, from Big Macs to Freddos, they're smaller than they used to be. As a child, I never successfully filled a sticker album. Never got close. Completion was the rich kids' game. Us paupers had to contend ourselves with half-filled efforts. There were 2 things I always dreamt of. 2 bucket list sticker goals. The first was to swank into a newsagent's like a playboy and buy a whole box of the blighters. I achieved this goal last week, slamming a box for £36 on the counter and exiting feeling like an oil baron. The victory was hollow. Most were swaps. The second was to order the last remaining stickers I needed direct from Panini HQ. This too has been ticked off the list. The bespoke selection are in transit as we speak. In short, I will soon have first fully completed sticker album. And what exactly will I do with it? Well, I won't be showing it off. If anything, the fuller the album gets, the more ashamed of it I become. I suspect I will slip it away quietly, secreted between the more earnest tomes on my bookcase. Maybe I'll dig out this heirloom years hence, when stickers cost £14 for 3 and I'm genuinely about to kick the bucket. But even if I never get it out again, at least there will be 2 things struck off the list.
Next, we have a Sky News article from the 16th of March 2025, as part of their series Looking into Occupations. This article examines what it's really like to be a bodyguard. Close Protection Officer James, who asked for his surname to remain anonymous, tells the Sky News Money team about an often unpredictable role that can involve everything from handling intoxicated celebrities to hurling rioters over hedges. James explains that clients fall into one of several categories. There are the very rich individuals and their families, those who require discreet yet comprehensive security for their homes, their travel and their daily lives. Then you have celebrities, often dealing with stalkers, intrusive paparazzi, potential break-ins or even death threats. Lesser known are the corporate executives in high-risk areas, or businesses and staff in hostile environments. And occasionally we get wealthy tourists, those travelling in high-crime locations who want an added layer of security. 90% of it is sheer monotony and endless waiting. It's also physically and mentally demanding. And the freelance nature means income isn't always steady. Success often depends on recognising the absence of the normal and the presence of the abnormal. Being able to anticipate threats before they arise is crucial. This includes avoiding predictable routes, reading the environment and understanding subtle changes in people's behaviour, strong communication skills, quick decision-making and the ability to remain calm under pressure are also essential. Some clients refuse to follow advice. The worst cases involve clients who get drunk, aggressive or reckless, put themselves in danger. One of my most difficult experiences was looking after a Bollywood actor in Manchester overnight. He was extremely drunk, rude to women, and nearly got into a fight with the venue's doorman. My role wasn't to babysit him, and I wasn't comfortable the way he behaved. After that job, I refused to work for the company again. Building a good reputation is key. Some full-time corporate positions exist, but most of us work on short-term contracts. Recruitment is all about word of mouth and networking. Hours are often long and unpredictable, sometimes ranging from 12 to 16 hours a day. Your tasks could include escorting high-profile client to meetings, conducting security advance sweeps of venues to check for threats, and ensuring everything runs smoothly. Managing vehicle arrangements is crucial, always knowing their locations in case of an emergency. The best perks for bodyguards are travelling to exotic locations, being around high-end vehicles, and staying in some of the world's most luxurious hotels. I was a butler's red coat, but then fate intervened in the form of an aggressive teenager who underestimated the combat capabilities of a man in a bear suit. Unfortunately, Butland's security was not as understanding as one might hope, and thus ended the promising career of Billy the Bear. From there, I took the logical next step, joining the military. There are two classic routes into the job, military or law enforcement. First, you get some tactical experience and learn how to keep your head. Then you transition into the private sector, swapping a uniform for a suit and an earpiece. It's not about being expected to take a bullet. It's about proactive protection, strategic planning, and maintaining a secure environment. That said, I'm fully committed to doing whatever it takes to ensure my clients' safety, including putting myself in harm's way. On one occasion, I was assigned to protect a camera crew who were adamant on filming in Salford during the UK riots in 2011. Three men in hoodies spotted the camera and moved in. One of them attempted to attack the cameraman, but I'd been blending in, always wearing a hoodie, standing right next to him. At the last moment, I shouted for the cameraman to run to a pre-arranged rendezvous where our safety car was parked. The aggressor didn't see me until it was too late. I launched him over a hedge and ran behind the cameraman to ensure he got away safely. Striking a good work-life balance is difficult. The long hours, last-minute jobs, and travel make work-life balance tough. Many bodyguards struggle with family time and relationships. Entry-level close protection officers in the UK can expect to earn around £40,000 to £50,000 a year. High-end roles for very rich individuals or celebrities can sometimes pay £1,000 plus a day.
Our next item is from the BBC News Future Earth newsletter, published on the 24th of March 2026. Climate editor Justin Rowlatt reports on the health benefits offered by the recently created King Charles III England Coast Path. The length of the path isn't really the point. That was how Neil Constable of Natural England summed up the ambition behind the King Charles III England Coast Path. What really matters, he told me, is that you can now go to the coast anywhere in England, turn left or right, and walk beside the sea for as long as you like. Because the path is about more than just access, it is about behaviour. The aim is to get more of us outside in the beautiful English coastal countryside more often. And that's not just as a lifestyle choice. Spending time in nature is increasingly being treated as an important health intervention. In recent years, NHS England has explored what it calls green social prescribing, where patients are encouraged to spend time in nature to improve their physical and mental health. That's because the evidence of health benefits is becoming much clearer. Let's start with mental health. A growing body of research points in the same direction. Time spent in nature is linked to higher levels of happiness, stronger resilience, and better social connection. A study published last year in the journal Nature Cities, combining the results of multiple research papers, went further, finding that exposure to nature can reduce depression and anxiety while improving overall well-being. The effects were particularly strong among young adults, a group for whom mental health challenges have been rising. The conclusion was clear. Expanding access to green spaces is not just desirable, it is a practical way to improve our mental health. More than 1,000 miles of new paths have been created for the route. The impact appears to be almost immediate. Scientists say our bodies respond within moments of encountering nature. Being amongst trees, hearing birdsong, even smelling the earth can trigger measurable physiological changes. We see changes such as lowering of blood pressure as your heart beats slower, all associated with physiological calming. Baroness Kathy Willis, a biodiversity professor at the University of Oxford, explained. Spending time in nature has also been linked to improvements in physical health. An evidence review from researchers at UCL found that people with better access to green space may have lower blood pressure, lower risks of cardiovascular disease, and lower rates of obesity and diabetes. There is nothing mysterious about this. It comes down to movement. A stroll along the coast may not feel like exercise, but it is. And even relatively gentle activity has a powerful effect on the body over time. That is why official guidance encourages people to be active every day, building up to at least 150 minutes of moderate activity each week. So, if your heart rate lifts, your breathing quickens, and you feel a little warmer, it's likely your body is benefiting. Meanwhile, some sections of the path have been made suitable for wheelchair users and people with impaired mobility. So, enjoy the entire 2,689 miles of the new King Charles III England Coast Path, if you want, or just one short section now and then. Either way, you can be confident you are engaging in one of the simplest forms of preventative healthcare available. And what's more, once you're on the coast path, it won't cost a thing to enjoy.
April is here, spring is springing, and it's Easter in the Mardler Library. Now, whilst Easter isn't as popular for seasonal themed books as Christmas, there are a few fiction gems out there that feature the holiday prominently. Let's begin this month's book corner with Easter Bunny Murder by Leslie Meyer. Spring has arrived in Tinker's Cove, and Lucy Stone has a mile-long to-do list, from painting eggs with her grandson to preparing the perfect Easter feast, as well as reviving her garden after a long, cold winter. She hardly has time to hunt for a killer with a deadly case of spring fever. As Lucy gathers a basket full of suspects, she's convinced someone's hunting for a lot more than eggs. So she must chase the truth down a rabbit hole before the killer claims another victim. There is an even more sinister crime to investigate in our next book choice, which is The Cruelest Month by Louise Penny. Set in the tiny, forgotten village of the Three Pines, where spring is welcomed as buds open on the trees and the first flowers struggle through the recently thawed earth. But not everything here is meant to return to life. A group of villagers decide to celebrate Easter with a séance at the old Hadley house, hoping to rid the town of its evil curse. However, one of their party dies, seemingly of fright. Was this a natural death, or was the victim somehow helped along? Brilliant, compassionate Chief Inspector Armand Gamache is called to investigate. This case will force him to face his own ghosts, as well as those of this seemingly idyllic place where relationships are far more dangerous than they appear to be. For many people, Easter would not be complete without an Easter egg. Our next book is chosen with chocoholics in mind, as it includes some wonderful descriptions of chocolate within its pages. Chocolat by Joanna Harris is a timeless novel about the awakening of a straight-laced village to the feeling of joy. Set in a tiny French village where nothing much has changed in 100 years, beautiful newcomer Vianne Rocher sets up her exquisite chocolate shop, which instantly plays havoc with the villagers' Lenten vows. Each box of luxurious bonbons comes with a free gift. Vianne has an uncanny perception about its purchasers' private problems and devises a clever, caring cure for them. Is she a witch? Soon the villagers no longer care as they abandon themselves to temptation and happiness in a dramatic face-off between Easter solemnity and the pagan gaiety of a chocolate festival. If you're a lover of romance books, you might enjoy Dr. Bright's Expectations by Abigail Gordon. Nurse Antonia Bliss first met consultant paediatrician Jonathan Bright when she was dressed as an Easter bunny, entertaining the children's ward. Despite their initial mutual attraction, Jonathan's expectations of love had been battered from past experience, causing him to doubt the seriousness of his deepening feelings for Antonia. Instead, he finds many excuses to keep her at a distance. And finally, if you will be celebrating Easter with your grandchildren or great-grandchildren, you might like to read Ladybird Stories for Easter. Brought to you by Ladybird Books, this is a heartwarming and engaging collection of original audio stories celebrating Easter. We meet several different families as they spend Easter together, from church services and sacred traditions to egg hunts and family times at home. These fun and informative stories are aimed at family listening with children aged 3 to 6. If you would like to read some of these books, you can borrow or request all of them from your favourite audio library, such as Calibra, the RNIB Library, or Norfolk County Libraries. You can even listen to them on the internet or an Alexa smart speaker. Whatever you choose to read this month, I do hope you enjoy it.
To finish off this edition of the magazine, we have an on-the-spot report from our peripatetic volunteer, Beverly Hopkins, where she talks to Cromer Lifeboat coxswain mechanic Paul Watling and RNLI museum volunteer Brian Pitkin.
Hello, Paul and Brian. Thank you so much for inviting me to talk to you about what happens here at the RNLI for our listeners at the Mardler Talking newspaper. Perhaps you can tell me a bit about what happens here.
Well, I'm Cox Mechanic here, full-time. I'm the only full-time person on the station that after the maintenance on boat associated equipment, 10 call-outs whenever needed.
And so far this year, how many?
We haven't had many this year because we've been sort of crew this year. We've missed a couple, but we've now sort of got our crew numbers back up. Service, I think we've only had about 3-4 shouts in total.
That's good news, though,
that's
isn't it?
That's with the ILB, which is the all-weather boat. Okay. The ILB, we've had quite a few call-outs.
Have you?
Yeah. Okay. They've been in now quite a bit with swimmers and stuff like that.
Yes, I should imagine that happens quite a bit, doesn't it?
Yeah, there is a few other episodes which we don't normally talk about as well. Well, we can't.
You can't talk about them. Okay, no. Understood.
So we had a few of them as well.
And so what do you do as a mechanic, did you say?
I'm coxswain and mechanic.
Coxswain,
yeah. Okay. So, I look after all the maintenance on the boat and the save the kit as well and command the boat when we're on call-outs. Yeah, so here at Crum we have a really good visits team, so if anybody wants to book a group of people in for a visit, they can come into the station and the team will talk to them about the RNLI and also show them videos. We've also got interactive stuff up on top of our viewing gallery, a couple of screens up there, which again people can interact with and also walk along the side of the boat.
Now, I've been coming up on holiday here before I moved up from London. We kind of watched this building being built. How long has it been here?
99, I think, that was built in here. That was before my time here. I've only been here 20 years, but well, I've been doing the RNLI 40 years in total. I had 20 years at Haysborough as well. 2007, the time I came. And before that, we had a tying class.
Those are the names of the boats?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they're the names of the boat.
Thank you very much. Okay. And Brian, perhaps you'd like to tell us about your volunteering.
Well, I'm at the Henry Blogg Museum, which is one of the RNLI's historic buildings. We have a collection there, a listed RNLI boat, the Bailey, H.F. Bailey, which was built in 1934, served through until 1947, I believe it is. The museum is dedicated to Henry Blogg, who was a coxswain here for many years. Many years, I think.
Many years, yeah.
And was a local person.
Yes, indeed. There's a memorial to him, isn't there?
There is.
Outside the
most decorated RNLI coxswain that there was. The museum itself has a number of exhibits dedicated to the RNLI service here in the community, a number of rescues that were performed at sea through the 30s and during the war, Second World War, that is, of course, as well to particular members of the crew. There's a display of Henry's medals and some interesting photos that take you back to Cromer of the 30s and 40s. The Bailey itself is really a timepiece. I mean, boats just aren't constructed in that manner any longer. It never capsized. It came close,
did
but
it
never
yeah.
did. It's really a testament to the craftsmanship. So the Bailey itself is really a testament to the skill of and craftsmen that built boats back in the 30s. It's 45 foot long. It's got a beam of about 16 feet, solid mahogany and teak with oak, and every screw is turned so that they all line up. It really is something to see, and I've had many people come, not just from the UK, but also some Scandinavians who just marvel when they see the craftsmanship. So that's well worth the trip. There are videos with audio that people with impairments can either see or listen to, depending upon their impairment, and some interactive material as well. We have interactive material for children, so certainly families are encouraged to come along. And there is the RNLI shop, which is quite extensive and relies, of course, on the visitors to make their donations.
I can understand that.
Because the organization is voluntary. It's funded through donations. The 238 stations in the United Kingdom and the Republic of Ireland, considerable amount of money to maintain them.
I can absolutely understand that.
Together with the training for the crews, of course. Unfortunately, at the moment, the Henry Blogg Museum is closed for renovations, and we don't have a date for reopening at this point. But I can assure your listeners that it will be bigger and better than ever, and well worth the visit.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Thank you. Paul, I understand you've got some interesting stories about your service calls.
Yeah, we had the first time showing on saving lives at sea for our inshore boat. That's the first time that we've been actually on the programme. It was a couple of weeks ago. That was quite an interesting service call for the lads. That was a went in after his dog got into trouble. But we saved both lives there, the dog and his, for that one. So that was a good outcome. IRB-wise, well, we have quite a few long calls. Last year we had probably 7 calls, and I think 5 of them were over 50 miles off. The longest being 75. That was after a aeroplane EPIR, that's an emergency beacon that has gone off. Supposedly when they crash land or whatever, that sets off these beacons. But we were out there for, I think this total call was about 10, 12 hours. We did have one as well where we picked up a yacht about 40 miles off, towed it all the way to Humber at 6 knots. That was a 10 o'clock at night call. And I think I walked in my house the following morning at about, I think it was about 2 in the afternoon.
So I'd just like to thank you then on behalf of us all. Thank you for risking your life to save ours. Thank you. And thank you, Brian, as well for your input. Lovely. Nice to meet you all.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of articles include the approval of a 124-acre solar farm, plans to improve mobile phone coverage, changes to bin collections, and the green light for changes to a caravan site in East Runton.
A bid to build a 124-acre solar farm in the Norfolk countryside has been given the green light, following a narrow vote. Councillors at Broadland Council have agreed to grant permission for developers to build the farm off Hayden Road in Hayden, after a vote saw 6 in favour and 4 against. The plans, which were submitted by Grupotec Solar UK, will see the land transformed with enough panels to power 7,500 homes in the area a year for around 40 years. It has sparked numerous objections from those living nearby and from Norfolk County Councillor Greg Peck, who feared solar parks on arable land is a massive threat to our future food supply. But the councillors on the planning committee decided the benefits of producing renewable energy outweighed the harm of the temporary loss of agricultural land, even if it is deemed as best and most versatile. In the planning committee meeting, Rona Bulwer-Long, who is responsible for the Hayden estate and the land for the solar farm, said approval of the farm will help found a new reservoir. This in turn would enable them to grow onions and potatoes across the farm, she argued, and said the local farmer who will graze his sheep on the solar farm will be able to increase his flock. The net result will be more food for human consumption going to the supply chains from Hayden, not less, she added. However, Councillor Joe Copplestone objected to the application and raised concern that the whole appearance of the area will be changed. But while Vice Chairwoman Eleanor Lamming recognised that it will change the appearance of the land, she argued, it is beneficial for the district and the country. The benefits of the proposal do outweigh the harms. Chairwoman Caroline Karimi Gavonalu agreed and said that this is one of the better applications and argued that it is very difficult to find low-quality land in Norfolk in response to fears about the temporary loss of arable land. The park would be connected to the Sal substation nearby, and it has been estimated that it will power around 7,500 homes and save approximately 13,000 tonnes of CO2 each year.
Having a good mobile phone signal has become something of a postcode lottery for people across North Norfolk. From problems with making emergency calls to accessing modern services like mobile banking and online GP appointments, poor service has affected many across the region. But now, a conversation with network operators has revealed promising details over the future of mobile connectivity, North Norfolk District Council has said. A meeting has been held between the council and Vodafone and Three, one of the top mobile operators in the area, to discuss the problems locals face and a way forward together. While the majority of what was discussed was commercially sensitive, it has been said that objectives have been set out to reach ambitious coverage targets, including key not-spot areas. Plans were also mentioned which improve not only connectivity but capability, as the population of the area is predicted to grow and there is a seasonal increase footfall over the summer months. Councillor Victoria Holliday, chairwoman of the Overview and Scrutiny Committee, said, "News about investments in North Norfolk's mobile connectivity is hugely welcomed. It is encouraging to hear there are plans to improve signal and coverage for those currently unable to make emergency calls, look after the vulnerable, and transact business. This is a positive start to ending the postcode lottery of mobile connectivity in North Norfolk. Tim Adams, leader of North District Council, has recognised the poor signal in the region. He said, "There are lots of areas where signal has been really poor and we are far behind where we should be." He added that it was good that the conversation has started, but remains a bit sceptical until locals start noticing a difference. Recently, those living in Wyndham have also been facing major phone signal problems, with many being left with no service for nearly a month.
Households across parts of Norfolk will see changes to their bin collections as new national recycling rules come into effect. The councils of North Norfolk, Breckland and South Norfolk are expected to conduct weekly food waste collections by this month. Despite the April deadline, Great Yarmouth Borough Council has warned it will not be able to collect food scraps this soon. It estimates this might not be possible until 2027 due to problems with sourcing new vehicles and waste bins. West Norfolk, Broadland and Norwich councils already collect food waste. It comes as new, simpler recycling reforms are being implemented across all local authorities in England by the government. Despite the date of changes being March the 31st, all councils in Norfolk have been accepting the same materials in home recycling bins since 2014. To help people prepare, here is a guide on what people can put in their bins from this month. Recycling bin. Newspapers, magazines and telephone directories. Paper and clean cardboard. Plastic bottles, such as drinks, detergent, shampoo and plastic milk bottles. Leave the lids on. Steel and aluminium food and drinks cans. Empty aerosols, glass bottles and jars, leave the tops on. Plastic food pots, tubs and trays, such as yoghurt pots, ice cream containers and margarine tubs. Waxed and Tetra Pak cartons, such as those used for juices and soups. Foil and foil trays. Shredded paper. Envelopes, including window type, greetings cards and junk mail, wrapping paper. Food waste caddy. Leftovers, fruit and vegetable peelings and cores, eggshells and salad, coffee grounds and tea bags, meat and fish, including bones, cooked and uncooked, out of date or mouldy food. General rubbish bin. Use your rubbish bin for anything that doesn't go in your recycling bins or food waste caddy. For example, broken crockery, food pouches, nappies, pet waste, vacuum dust and sweepings, broken toys, polystyrene, glassware and Pyrex.
A host of changes proposed for a Norfolk caravan and campsite park have been given the go-ahead. Plans to develop Seacroft Camping Park in East Runton with a range of new features have been approved by North Norfolk District Council. The bid submitted by the Caravan and Motorhome Club last summer will see five new pitches on the site and moving the existing play area and creating a new multi-use games area. It also included demolishing the toilet block and replacing it with a new one, a site manager's pod and an extension to the bar and restaurant building on the site off Cromer Road. The company said in its planning documents that the works would allow the growth of an established touring facility which makes a significant contribution to the local economy. It described the existing play area as in poor condition and causes numerous health and safety issues on site, and said the new one will comprise a mix of equipment. The documents added that the toilet block is nearing the end of its life, which is why it applied to tear it down and build a new one to offer a more efficient arrangement. The council's planning officer approved the bid and said the proposed development will not negatively impact residential amenity and will not alter the character or appearance of the area, considering the extent of the work and the current screening. However, several conditions have been imposed with the plans. This includes one that said the use of the play area should only be between 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. every day to minimise noise disturbance for neighbours. The Seacroft Club campsite has been functioning on the site near Cromer since the 1980s. It features 108 pitches that include a combination of all-weather, grass camping options, along with a swimming pool, bar, restaurant and a children's play area.
A restaurant based in a historic harbour building has revealed its opening date and menu of local sourced food. Chandlery, the first restaurant from sommelier and maitre d' Bert Blaise, is launching in a building overlooking Wells next to Sea Harbour. Mr. Blaise opened North Norfolk Cellars, a wine shop and bar, at the site in 2024 and is planning to offer seasonal Norfolk-inspired cuisine and an extensive wine list featuring around 400 varieties at the new venue. The eatery has announced an opening date of May the 1st, with people now able to book a reservation. Food will be led by head chef Harry Williams, who has previously worked at the Gym Trap Inn, which held 3 AA rosettes during his tenure, as well as Number 29 and the Stiffkey Red Lion. Mr. Williams' cooking focuses on ingredients sourced from fishermen, farmers and growers across Norfolk. The menu has also been revealed, including meals such as spatchcock Norfolk quail with Madeira sauce and puffed barley, as well as lobster toast and bisque, and heritage tomato with blood orange and buckwheat.
Railway lovers will once again be able to tuck into a British classic as they enjoy a train journey through the Norfolk countryside. A fish and chip train experience is set to return to the North Norfolk Railway with 26 journeys announced for 2026. Ticket holders will enjoy an evening out in the railway with cod and chips cooked in beef fat from one of Sheringham's top chip shops. Diners will be seated in either the Gresley buffet car, restored to its original condition with its 1930s Art Deco interior, or in one of the 1950s British Railways carriages. The ticket includes travel, fish and chips, and a locally made tub of Ronaldo's ice cream to finish. There is also a licensed bar on board for those looking to enjoy a tipple or two. The trains run from Sheringham to Holt and back, with the return journey taking approximately 90 minutes. The Norfolk Friar steams out of Sheringham from April 1st to September the 30th, with advanced booking absolutely vital for these popular trains. Tickets start at £87.50 for a table of two. Gluten-free and vegetarian options are also available.
A zoo in North Norfolk has welcomed the arrival of 10 new feathered friends. Amazona Zoo in Cromer has seen the arrival of the new flamingos, famously known as a flamboyance, from Longleat Safari Park in Wiltshire. Imogen White, manager of Amazona, said, "We have four which are only 6 to 7 months old, so you'll be able to watch them grow and change colour. They are settling in really well. They are a mixture of ages, from 23 years old to just 6 months old. The young can be spotted easily as they have grey plumage for around 2 to 3 years old before turning pink. Our flamingos have access to the whole lake, and whilst they have met our existing flock and are getting on well, they are yet to venture very far from their shed." The zoo, located in Cromer, is home to more than 200 tropical animals, including a jaguar, monkeys, snakes, and pumas.
An art group is welcoming visitors to Cromer after installing a new exhibition. Full-size reproductions of contemporary art are now displayed free around Cromer as part of its Bigger Picture exhibition. Installed by Cromer Art Space, the 24-piece show featuring work from the Towney Eastbourne collection will be displayed in prominent public spaces for the next year. Guided walks will be available through the summer, with the next two on May the 6th and June the 9th. More information at cromerartspace.uk/thebiggerpicture/towner in Cromer.
Our last few articles cover an Easter circus in Sheringham, major restoration work completed at Felbrick Hall, homeless hedgehogs, and the £3.5 million project for a medieval church in Briston.
A circus is back in North Norfolk with fresh acts for all ages. Russell's International Circus is pitched in Sheringham this Easter with a new show, Under the Big Top, running until April the 12th. Featuring more than 20 international performers, the show promises a night of high-energy acts, daredevil stunts and classic circus magic. Sheringham is always a highlight of our tour and we enjoy coming back each year, circus director Rusty Russell said. This year, we have an all-new spectacular show that we are sure people will enjoy, including a cast of more than 20 international performers. Among the highlights this year is the Wheel of Death, along with the debut of Mexican clown David Marquez, who joins the Russell's International Circus for the first time. Mr. Russell added, "We have wanted to get David with us for many years, as comedy is always an integral part of our show, and he is one of the best." Audience members can also look forward to a lively mix of acrobatics and family-friendly entertainment. The lineup also includes Clown Wilbo, Ariel Chandelier, Miss Liana and Hermias, the Bounce Ball Juggler. The Big Top will be pitched at Cookie's Car Boot Site on Cromer Road throughout the duration of its stay. Tickets can be booked online in advance or in person at the on-site box office. A special midweek offer means all seats are priced at £9.99 every Wednesday and Thursday. Tickets are expected to sell quickly and guests are encouraged to book early to avoid missing out.
A major restoration project has been completed at a historic estate. The 7-month scheme at the National Trust's Felbrigg Hall in North Norfolk focused on the Southern Corridor, a 36-metre-long service wing dating back to the 1750s. Work included removing, repairing and realigning the entire roof to improve water drainage and protect the structure from damage caused by climate change. "We are thrilled to reopen the south corridor of Felbrigg Hall after 7 months of construction, Judith McKenzie, project manager for the National Trust, said. Visitors will once again be able to enjoy the full route through the house now that it's protected from future weather conditions. It is thanks to our funders, National Trust members and visitors that projects such as this can happen. The upgraded drainage system now directs rainwater into a sustainable system, including 10,000-litre harvesting tank for garden use. Internal restoration has also reinstated an early 20th century colour scheme with buff-painted lime plaster walls, crimson windows and chocolate-coloured woodwork. Miss McKenzie explained that hidden repairs like these are vital for the long-term preservation of the building. She said, "Caring for things out of sight, such as roofs and drainage systems, allows us to protect the wider fabric of the hall and its collection, so that more people can experience them for many years to come." The project was particularly funded by a grant from the Wolfson Foundation, as well as donations from National Trust members and money raised through Felbrigg's second-hand bookshop. Improvements have extended to the grounds, where the neighbouring rose garden now features step-free Yorkstone paths and additional cast-iron benches. Visitors to the hall begin their tour in the south corridor, which houses rooms used by estate workers in past centuries. These include the estate office, servants' hall and tenants' waiting room.
Losing a garden centre is bad enough, but the prospect of making hedgehogs homeless at the same time seems a step too far for many. Plans to demolish Overstrand Garden Centre and replace it with 15 new homes have run into opposition from people concerned it will destroy habitats for the creatures. Every single one of the 14 objections to the scheme lodged with North Norfolk District Council cites the impact on hedgehogs as a reason for their opposition. One person wrote, "Surely a solution can be found where both the development and the hedgehogs can work in harmony. We simply cannot just eradicate our wildlife." Another added, "This development would be devastating for wildlife, which cannot stand up for itself against it." Amongst those opposed to the project is Maggie Wilcox, who lives in the village and records passing wildlife nightly on her live stream on YouTube. She started a national petition mentioning the Overstrand case, which calls for stronger legal protections for hedgehogs and has already attracted more than 200,000 signatures. "This isn't just another housing proposal," she said. "The site sits within a network of gardens, hedgerows and green spaces, the kind of connected habitat hedgehogs depend on to move, forage and survive. Break those links and you don't just lose land, you lose connectivity." The possible presence of hedgehogs in the area was flagged in an ecological report carried out on behalf of Victoria Sheridan, who owns the site on Munsley Road and wants to build the new homes. She closed down the garden centre in 2024, saying it was no longer financially viable. The report said, "It is conceivable that transient individuals of hedgehog may occasionally be present within the proposal site." It said it was possible for hedgehogs to venture into the site during construction and that they may become trapped. However, it added that once the site was developed, it is unlikely that there would be any long-term in-use impacts on hedgehog, adding there was only a potential for a minor negative impact on them. Objectors have called for the proposals to include so-called hedgehog highways, which are 13-centimetre gaps in fences for the creatures to pass through. A decision will be made in due course.
an exciting opportunity to secure £3.5 million to restore a Norfolk medieval church deemed at risk has sparked a call to locals. Those living in Briston near Holt have been urged to help shape the future of its All Saints Church after a chance to secure a multi-million pound national lottery investment emerged. A £3.5 million project called Opening the Doors at All Saints has been launched to restore and secure the building's future, which is currently on Historic England's Heritage at Risk register. The church now wants to bid for the lottery funds and is urging locals to support. "This is a really exciting moment for All Saints," said project lead and rector, Reverend Dr. Trudy Morris. "We want this to be a project shaped by local people, not done to them. Whether you love the church, have never stepped inside it, or feel it's not for you, we really want to hear your views. To make the church a space for all, the project team is planning essential upgrades to improve access and comfort. These include accessible toilets and baby changing facilities, a kitchenette for hot drinks and community meals, and efficient green heating and innovations like solar tiles. It also hopes to make level, accessible paths in the churchyard and flexible pew seating for arts events." The Reverend Caroline Sexton, Assistant Minister, said, "As a local resident for over 45 years, I have seen our church slowly deteriorate year by year, despite regular patching. We now have a wonderful opportunity, with the help of the National Lottery Heritage Fund, to make it a space for everyone that is both warm and fully accessible. Before the final plans are made to submit the bid, the church is asking locals to help shape the project's activities and events by completing a short community survey. A link to the form can be found online at bandbchurches.co.uk, and people have until April the 15th to share their views."
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Watterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineers today were Richard Wilson and Daniel Butterworth. Editing and producing this issue were Chris and Lorna Wilson. But do keep listening, as immediately following this edition of The Mardler, you can hear items from the Talking News Federation. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio!
DNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, my name is Lindsay.
I started producing topical items during lockdown to keep my neighbours entertained. All the recordings are made inside my cosy cabin for that extra sense of calm. And naturally enough, I call them cabin conversations. I hope you enjoy them. Cabin conversations about Easter Monday traditions. Easter Sunday, the main event, will fall on the 5th of April this year, with the Easter Monday public holiday on the 6th of April for England, Wales and Northern Ireland. Scotland now has several local authorities acknowledging the Easter Monday holiday, and while the rest of Britain officially declared it under the Bank Holidays Act of 1871, Scottish banks only changed their opening days from 1996. As for the actual calendar date, the earliest possible Mondays are the 23rd of March and the latest the 26th of April. So why do these celebration dates vary each year? Well, it all relates to different faith calendars deciding the set beginning of the spring equinox in March, combined with the new full moon in the same period. Whereas in reality, the seasons actually shift according to astronomy calculations. Emperor Constantine, the first Christian Roman leader in 325 AD, had the first council of Christian bishops stipulate when Easter should occur. They chose the first Sunday after the full moon, on or after the spring equinox, on the 21st of March, the same as today's observance. But it did not close the matter for many more centuries. Celtic Britain even wanted their own way, commemorating Good Friday on a Thursday. In England, a case of providence was argued between Celtic monks and Roman monks, which was settled by the Northumbrian King Oswy, who, despite having been raised in a Celtic kingdom and following their customs, his native Kent wife practised Roman. Oswy requested the Synod of Whitby Abbey in 664 to formally agree on Easter. They chose in favour of the Roman calendar and traditions, thus creating harmony in the royal court and structure for the country. Naturally, this upset the Celtic monks' leader, Bishop Colman of Lindisfarne, who promptly resigned and took his fellow devout monks with him to Scotland, never to return. Therefore, faith days have remained quite strict, though the Easter Monday public holiday less so, with mainly pagan-influenced activities across the UK. The Hocktide festival holiday, spanning both Monday and Tuesday after Easter, originated from medieval times, around the 11th century, and marks the end of winter on the land. Celebrated for 2 weeks in Hungerford, Berkshire today, it is an opportunity for the parish to raise funds. A town crier calls Hocktide Court in the privately owned town hall, while the Tutti men, or Tutti women these days, walk door to door carrying their Tutti wooden poles, atopped with flower posies and ribbons. Their job to collect small tithe fees. They are accompanied by Tutti girls with wicker baskets of sweets and someone with a sack of oranges, so that residents who pay can receive an orange in exchange. These tithes, or rents, are for fishing the local rivers and cattle grazing on the common, along with rights to pick watercress. Afterwards, a grand feast using local fish, beef and watercress to symbolise further the event. Many ancient and old customs are involved during the festival, ale tasting and a blacksmith simulating horseshoeing a newcomer to the feast. In Leicestershire, a bottle-kicking match takes place, a custom thought to go back 2,000 years. The two villages of Hallerton and Medbourne first parade a hare rabbit pie through the streets and behind three small wooden barrels, described originally as bottles, one solid wood and the other two filled with beer. The object of the game is to move the best of three barrels to the other side of one of the village streams, by whatever means possible, as having no official rules. In fact, it has been likened to an early form of rugby. The winning team who gets any barrel onto the village green takes the spoils. Another Herculean race is held in Gawthorpe, Wakefield, Yorkshire, for the World Coal Carrying Championships, split into several categories. The children's fun run, for a distance of 100 yards or 91 metres to the village green. All the adults, men, women and veterans 40 years and over, start their races from the public house in Ossett, covering 0.6 of a mile or 1,012 metres to finish at the Maypole Green in Gawthorpe. The only variation between them being the weight carried. The women each take 44 pounds, that's 20 kilos of coal, and the men 110 pounds, or 50 kilos of coal. Despite the hindrance of carrying such weights, the men's record set in 1995 was 4 minutes, 6 seconds. Although for many, Easter Monday means reflecting on the value of faith and leisure time spent with family and friends. May you mark the end of winter and the beginning of spring in your own distinct way.
Next up is Charlotte from Guide Dogs with some exciting news.
Hello, this is Charlotte from Guide Dogs, back with another update. Things have changed quite a lot since I last updated you. I was recently successful in applying for a different role in Guide Dogs, working for the Buddy Dog Service. This role involves assessing dogs that have not made it through guide dog training to see if they would be suitable to be matched with a child with sight loss as a buddy dog. Buddy dogs do not do any guiding. They function more as a support dog for the whole family and can help build confidence and skills for the child that they are partnered with. I will still be using my skills as a trainer, as the dogs do need some additional training to become a buddy, but I will also be interviewing families, conducting experience days, matching partnerships, and maintaining existing partnerships. This role will be covering the southwest of England and South Wales, so sadly I will be moving away from Hertfordshire. However, I can continue doing updates about the dogs I am working with in the buddy dog scheme if the interest is there. For now, I have no dogs to update on, as Buttons was reassigned to a trainer at our large training centre at Redbridge. For now, I will chat a little bit about buddy dogs and how we assess the dogs that have come out of training. All dogs that have been deemed unsuitable for guiding will be considered for buddy dogs, but the criteria is quite strict. Any sort of aggression to people or animals or nervousness around children will rule out a dog, as will behaviours like resource guarding, which could cause injury. Dogs with serious illnesses will not be considered. However, dogs with mild or asymptomatic conditions, like a very mild hip or elbow dysplasia or a mild skin condition, may still be accepted for buddy. Some dogs have issues that purely relate to guiding work, like not liking wearing the guiding harness, or have specific dislikes that can be mitigated by placing them with the right family. For example, a dog that hates travelling on public transport will struggle as a guide dog, but might be absolutely fine with a family who only travel by car. Overall, the dog must be an asset to the family rather than an additional stressor, so we were looking at exceptional social and home behaviour in dogs that go on to be buddies. Buddy dogs do not have the same rights of access as a working guide dog, but they do have a jacket that they wear to identify them as support dogs. Although there is no obligation, often shops, cafes and other businesses are happy to allow access to buddy dogs when they are accompanying their child. There is no expectation that a child partnered with a buddy dog will go on to apply for a guide dog, but if they decide to pursue guide dog mobility, having a buddy dog as a child is a great way to introduce them to the daily aspects of dog care, such as feeding, grooming, exercise and playtime. Children are also taught some basics about dog body language when applying for a buddy dog, which is useful not only for their own dog but for interacting with other dogs safely too. Families who wish to have a buddy dog must go through a multi-stage process to be accepted, which includes interviews, home checks, and several forms of online training and a meet and greet with a dog. In the same way that a guide dog owner must have a guide dog assessment, a buddy dog recipient must have a similar assessment that looks at every aspect of family life to assess suitability and allow for the best possible match. Every family has a different circumstance, and we match a whole range of dogs depending on the family's lifestyle and the dog's personality. Once a buddy dog is placed with a family, they will have a yearly check-in to make sure all is going well. I hope you found this chat about buddy dogs interesting, and I hope to be back in the future to give updates on my new role.
Hello, it's time to put your thinking cap on. It's Roger with a general knowledge quiz of 10 questions. Question 1. In Greek legend, who turned everything he touched to gold? Question 2. Which infamous person had the first names Orrental James? Think about it. Orrental James. Question 3. What's the national flower of Wales? Question 4. How many yards are in a furlong? Racing fans should know that one. Question 5. Excluding jokers, how many playing cards are there in a standard pack? Question 6. Which of these wedding anniversaries would you celebrate first? Golden, emerald, or ruby? Question 7. Maths. Ready? What is the average of the numbers 1, 2, 4, and 5? Time to think. 1, 2, 4, and 5. Question 8. One of the most obscure questions I've ever asked. What surname is shared by an ex-England footballer, midfielder, played for Liverpool, and a police officer who pursued the fugitive in the TV series and the film? Question 9. By what abbreviation is the International Criminal Police Organization better known? And question 10, finally, one you can have a reasonable stab at. One supermarket chain company in April 2005 became the first supermarket group to have an annual profit of over £2 billion. Big money. Answers later. Roger back with the answers to our 10 question general knowledge quiz. Here we go. Number 1. In Greek legend, who turned everything he touched into gold? Well, that was King Midas. King Midas. A bit of history here, pop music fans. That King Midas in Reverse was the first Hollies single that Graham Nash sang the lead on. All about everything he touched turned to dust. I'm King Midas in Reverse. Question 2. The famous person, or infamous person, who had the names of Orrental James as his first two names was O.J. Simpson. O.J. Simpson. Who'd have thought it? Question three. The national flower of Wales is, of course, the daffodil. Question four. There are 220 yards in a furlong. Question five. Excluding the jokers, there are 52 cards in a standard pack. Question six. Which of these wedding anniversaries would you celebrate first? Golden, emerald, or ruby? It is ruby. Question seven. What is the average of the numbers 1, 2, 4, and 5? It is 3. You add them together, 1, 2, that's 3, then 4, that's 7, and 5 makes 12, but you've got 4 numbers you've added. So the answer there is you divide the 12 by 4 and you get 3. This obscure TV come football question, Gerrard, Stephen Gerrard for Liverpool and England, and Lieutenant Gerrard, who chased our poor fugitive. Question nine. By which abbreviation is the International Criminal Police Organization better known? That's Interpol. Interpol. And question 10. Biggest supermarket chain, etc., was Tesco. Tesco. Hope you did well.
TNS Soundings.